I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Millions of people, probably a lot of you, have been working from home because of the pandemic, something that people with disabilities have been doing for years. On the other hand, if you have mobility issues, it's gotten tougher to navigate sidewalks because of the pandemic, now that restaurants have set up tables and chairs outside. Earlier this summer marked the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on jobs, schools, transportation, public and private places. Today on Radio Times, how to create smart, inclusive, and livable cities and communities based on the ideas, the experiences, and innovations of people with disabilities. And we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us by Skype is Victor Pineda. He's president of World Enabled. He's a recognized leader in international disability rights, was appointed by President Obama to the Architectural and Transportation Barriers Compliance Board. He's also a lecturer at UC Berkeley. He got up really early in the morning to join us. Victor Pineda, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us, Sarah Hendren. She's an artist, design researcher. She's a writer, professor at Olin College of Engineering. Wrote a new book called What Can a Body Do? How We Meet the Built World. And Sarah Hendren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And to our listeners, to join the conversation, and we do want you to do that, send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can tweet us at whyyradiotimes, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Victor Pineda, let me begin with you. First of all, how have you been managing during this pandemic? Has it changed your life at all? Do we have Victor?
Yes, I'm here.
I was trying to think about where to start. Okay, that's a big question. I guess the question is, how are you doing? How are you managing the pandemic?
Well, look, people with disabilities, all of us are facing new risks. And for me, personally, I use a wheelchair. I'm a quadriplegic. I use a ventilator to breathe. Medically, like, even though I travel the world and advise governments and teach and all this stuff, I actually have so productive but only use 9% of my lung capacity. So I use a machine to help me breathe
and we can hear that machine. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
COVID is putting a whole new set of risks to every decision that I have to make and every transaction and experience that has really, really high consequences. And I'm thinking a lot about cities as an urban planner and trying to think about what would a pandemic city look like for people with disabilities. How do we increase the capacity of people to participate in their city
while navigating new sets of places? And that's, I mean, in many ways, that's the reason that we wanted to do the show, is to open that up for conversation. And just so our listeners know, what we're hearing is your breathing machine. Let me turn to you, Sarah Hendren, and from your perspective, and even from this kind of design perspective that you have on this built world that we have created for ourselves, what do you see as the challenges for people with disabilities under the pandemic?
Well, I think it's a challenge for a lot of us in, of course, distinctive ways, as Victor just laid out. But it's interesting to think about if folks had not thought much about design, but design is kind of like the physical manifestation of ideas. And so we can look at the way the built world is shaped, and we can see in it ways that we can move about the built world and ways that are barriers to that. And I think it might be useful to point people to, for instance, the history of curb cuts, which was a change in the built environment. You know, that was a moment. So that's just the change in the curb where the sidewalk meets the street. There's now a ramp there between the sidewalk and the street where there had been a hard step down. And just a generation ago, the shape of the very built environment was changed. Why? To make wheelchair passage more possible in the built environment and therefore make a more elastic and friendly city, actually, for a lot of people whose bodies will also change over our lifespan. So in other words, we're acutely being asked to think in a new way about the way our bodies have implications for each other, so the use of masks and so on. But we are actually engaging in a much longer history that people with disabilities have been way out in front in thinking about making a friendlier city for a lot of kinds of bodies, and the creativity of that and also the urgency of it.
Well, I mean, curb cuts are great for people with wheelchairs, but also for strollers,
right,
Sarah.
That's
I'm thinking of the multiple uses that we all get out of the fact that there are now curb cuts.
That's right. And people point to this in my field in design as an example of what's called universal design. It's actually just one of many kinds of ways we can think about design. I mean, curb cuts were necessary as a civic right. They were the right thing to do. If you want a democratic city, you need to build it for all people to move around. But it also happens that there is this byproduct and follow-on effect that human bodies have lots of frictions when they meet the built world. So yes, if you, like me, you have pushed a stroller through the built environment, or you're walking a bike, or pulling wheeled luggage behind you, you also participate in those politics. And I'm interested as a researcher and in this book as a kind of journalist in citing those histories so that people awaken to the deep radicalism of that, and again, the creativity in asking the city to look different than it does currently. So we're seeing some of those prototyping shared streets and restaurants expanding onto sidewalks, and there are lots of complicated issues there. But boy, we are seeing some shifts happening in real time right now too.
Victor Pineda, let me go back to you. And I mentioned in my introduction that many people, myself included, are working from home. And I know that that's, the right to work from home has been something that people with disabilities have been fighting for. And yet, it's not perfect, and there are problems, and not everyone gets to do it, and it doesn't work for every job. But here we are kind of sharing this experience together. Can you speak to that?
Sure. I think the fact that we are jumping into the future by force, not so much by choice, is causing a lot of disruptions. But here's an example of sort of the curb cut effect that was just being mentioned earlier. The fact that you open up a new modality for engaging in public life, right? The opening up of working from home has been something that we've been fighting for, over the last 40 years. And now we've got this new normal. I, for example, have entered the work of academia and of consulting and of advising. But a lot of that work and lecturing required me getting on an airplane. And that was very, very toxic. I mean, I've traveled all over the world. The reality that we face is now that there's new sets of expectations of how to contribute. And some of those are making it easier for persons with disabilities. And some of those are making it harder. For example, and again, this is all very nuanced, because if you have a hearing impairment, you might be asked to join a Zoom room that doesn't have captioning, right? So you're completely left out of that conversation. If you are, for example, somebody with visual impairments, do you have the right types of tools and interfaces to be able to engage in that software, right? Is that software fully accessible?
Sure.
We've seen laws like the laws that were passed to shape the built environment being shaping the digital environment. And I had the honor of voting for Section 508, which required digital accessibility for all kinds of public services and all kinds of programs that we use day to day.
Which makes me want to answer, and I understand for some people with different kinds of disabilities, a Zoom meeting is not going to work for them. But, we've all gotten used to that, Victor Pineda. Are you good at Zoom meetings?
Yes.
You're skilled at that.
I was just on a call a few hours ago with Abu Dhabi, and we're talking about the the needs of that city to become more accessible. Get on more occasions than I've choose to admit, I started giving brilliant answers to challenging questions, but the microphone was on. The dust was off, so they kept reminding me to turn on my microphone. So yeah, it takes some getting used to. But I think the bigger question here is, what do we value, right? And how do we ensure that those values are embedded in both the physical environment, but also the digital environment? I think that's what Sarah was raising, is that the design, whether it's physical design or digital design, ultimately takes our ideas of what a fair world looks like and then puts it into the way we design our tools and our services and our products.
Sure, and I do want to pick up on that. Sarah, let me go back to you. And you write about your son, Graham, in this book as well. It's about many different things, but it also has a very personal story that you have to tell about having a child with Down syndrome and how perhaps that has helped you understand the world that we've created, how it maybe works for him sometimes, why it works against him sometimes. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, the book is mostly sort of journalistic tour through physical design in lots of places. So people who use prosthetic limbs, the design of furniture, the design of homes and urban planning. And at the end of the book, I do talk a little bit about design for developmental disability, because it's not an obvious place for design. And we think of design maybe as a kind of extension of the body to either bring the body to the world a little more easily or to bring the world to the body a little more easily. But again, in developmental disability, the kind of misfitting, so Rosemary Garland Thompson, who's a disability scholar, talks about disability as a misfit condition, which sounds like common sense, except she says a misfit is a square peg in a round hole. And what that means is that both of the misfit is actually running both ways. So the question to ask for somebody like my son Graham, who has Down syndrome, is he a misfit in the world, or is the world misfitting in its normative structures for him? And what would be the moves to make to try to make the world more capaciously expansive for all kinds of people to flourish, right? And that's been the question that he's helped me understand acutely in the 14 years of being his parent, but also he launched a decade of my own study professionally and into looking into this in the disability community for the last couple of decades. And I will say, I mean, you know, what is the kind of misfitting in Down syndrome? That non-normative intelligence is a misfit with the kind of normative economic time that we live under. So the misfit is not so much about replacement parts or about the sensory or mobility capacities of the body, but it's about his kind of misfit with becoming what a lot of us are conscripted to become, which is an economic unit as a measure of our worth, right? That can we proceed through school and the normative structures of jobs and become taxpaying citizens in a way that other people will see as worthy? And I think Down syndrome challenges that in a powerful way.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Sarah Hendren. She's an artist, design researcher, writer, professor at Olin College of Engineering. Victor Pineda with us as well, president of World Enabled. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with our guests about how to design smart, inclusive, and livable communities based on some of the ideas, the innovations, and experiences of people with disabilities. Our guests are Victor Pineda, he's president of World Enabled, and Sarah Hendren, author of a book called What Can a Body Do? How We Meet the Built World. And again, you can join us, whyy.org/radiotimes. You can tweet us at whyyradiotimes, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Victor, let me go back to you. And, you know, language is so important and so powerful. When Sarah used the word misfit, I scribbled it down. I also scribbled down disability, ability. In terms of language and what we mean when we say something like misfit or disability, do you think of yourself as a person with a disability?
Well, yes. I mean, we come from a intergenerational struggle to assert our place in the world, and we can talk about that as a concept of disability justice, which is to ensure that we have the foresight and the capacity to identify and eliminate those barriers that create unnecessary obstacles and limitations, and also the idea that you're not disabled by a medical condition. You're actually disabled by the way the world was designed, just as Sarah was saying, misfit, or as Kat Holmes talks about mismatch. It really is a dynamic experience where you are, in a sense, being deprived of choices, deprived capabilities, because of the way that you interact with the world. In a sense, your lifestyle or your preferences to engage with the world are being limited, and hence you're being disabled by design. So I do consider myself as somebody living with a disability, because I continue to navigate, you know, barriers and risks that really don't have to be there.
Sarah, let me go back to you, and you profile a number of people in your book, including a guy named Chris. He's an engineer. He doesn't have an arm. And there's a picture of him changing his baby's diaper with a design that he really created in order to be able to do that. Can you talk a little bit about Chris and what his experiences and innovations can teach us about this world we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what I want people to see in the book and in the places where design meets disability historically is, again, the creativity that comes with the urgency of the human rights. I mean, I think sometimes people can get their heads around the human rights issues, but they miss the creativity and ingenuity that's happening by disabled people. So, you know, Chris, as you said, he was born with one arm, and he was somebody for whom lots of prosthetic arms were built as a child and offered to him, but his body was sufficiently adaptive and plastic that he, like we all are, right, he was deeply adapting to his world as a one-armed person, and he mostly does his job as an engineer with his one hand and with his incredibly dexterous feet and toes, and the body is amazing this way. But he did find himself, when his newborn baby arrived, with what tends to be a two-handed task, and that is changing his baby's diaper. And so yeah. I profile him there. We meet him in that domestic setting to see that he actually wasn't somebody who wanted to get one of those universal arms that comes out of the laboratories and is this kind of gee whiz high-tech cyborg, you know, sort of breathless technology of the future, but instead is a quite humble and nimble and just-in-time set of objects that he created himself. It's like a little felted wool cord, you know, kind of harness that he hangs from the residual limb on his right side to suspend the ankles of his baby so that he can do the work of swapping out that diaper. And so that's in a chapter called Limb that joins a vast history of prosthetics. It is so fascinating that comes, yes, at the high-tech rehabilitation engineering that happens at the laboratories right now, but also happens in people's living rooms and happens globally across the world in low-tech forms and highly affordable and distributed for free forms like the Jaipur Foot in India at clinics all over India. And what I wanted people to see is that there's this ingenuity that is this realm of expertise and deep wisdom that everyone can learn from, and it's probably in places that you wouldn't expect.
I love that. Victor, let me go back to you. Is there a city that you have been to or you know about where you feel as if this sort of design and disability has come together to create a place that's easier to navigate, not just for people in a wheelchair as you are, but for everybody, that we've all benefited because of these design innovations?
Sure. I think that, so no city has it right. This is a journey. It's not a destination, and it is a very much about a complex set of factors that have to come together. But cities like Oslo or cities like Helsinki, some of those Nordic countries have a high premium on design, and they, since the 70s, had really great design thinkers putting their ideas of universal design into practice in the built environment. And part of the conversation that I had last night with the city of Abu Dhabi was describing how when I arrived to Oslo for a conference, I literally got off the plane. The train station was in the airport, so I didn't have to cross the street or get out of a cab or try to navigate other kinds of obstacles to get to my hotel, but got on a high-speed train that was fully accessible, a little ramp, came out of the train to the ease of my and to the delight of me and my traveling companions. Sat in the train, and just a couple hours later, I was on the other side of the country. I got off the train station, crossed the street, was able to check into my hotel without any conditional burdens. And that kind of design really is about ensuring that all kinds of bodies, you know, families and older persons. If I were to travel with my grandmother, I would love to go to Norway again, because I know that she would be able to go with me and we wouldn't have to encounter other obstacles.
Well, it's interesting you raise your grandmother. I think the CDC says something like 26% of the American population, you know, qualifies as quote unquote disabled, including, you know, older senior citizens, older people who over time oftentimes lose some of those abilities to navigate, Victor.
But let's look at the statistics. And I think, you know, Sarah's probably quite familiar with these as well, but nearly 25% of people on Earth experience barriers in navigating their environment, and that a big portion of those barriers are from people with disabilities and older persons. The other challenge is that the infrastructure that we've built really wasn't designed for everybody. It was a normative approach. In some ways, it really failed creativity. It failed this flexibility. I think we have that capacity, especially when you have the equivalent of 2 million people moving into cities every week. The rate of urbanization is something that we have to get a handle on. That the last part of this is that 60 to 70% of the infrastructure that we will need by 2050 has yet to be built.
Wow.
So we're virtually needing to more than double all of the roads, all of the hospitals, all of the schools, everything we've built as a human race in order to keep up with the demand for this infrastructure. So it really behooves us, it's in our enlightened self-interest to get this right, because disability is a category that we can all fall into at any time. And so we want to be able to face the future where we have dignity and choice and the freedom to live our lives and exercise, you know, the lifestyles and the lives that we want without having to negotiate unnecessary risks or dangers.
I mean, that's
or exclusions.
Sure. And Sarah, you want to speak to that, this sort of urbanization of populations. And, you know, we haven't built the environment to meet all those needs.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the really interesting and core issue here, it seems to me, is our examining closely the capacity to which we want to plan for and design for the condition of help, giving and receiving of help. That is what, I mean, in researching disability and reading so much about the lives of disabled people, it seems to me disability is personal and political needfulness, which is to say a deeply human condition, again, which doesn't make us all the same, but it does connect us, does it not? That we enter our lives deeply dependent, acutely dependent on other people. We often end our lives also in states of dependence, and we traffic in and out of those states in the course of our lives. So could we let that feature, which is to say the giving and receiving of help, full stop, be something that is visible and unifying, that we know we extend our bodies with all kinds of gear, but also that we live in ecosystems of care. And so isn't that a future that we want to design toward rather than designing against it? I mean, it gets at our core foundational ideas about what human connection is really about.
Suzanne from Overbrook left a comment, what recourse does someone with disabilities have when their apartment managers won't address and upgrade apartments to make them accessible? I'm struggling with this issue and trying to get a ramp put in so I don't have to crawl up the stairs. Suzanne, I'm really sorry to hear that. And Victor, let me put that to you because you sit on the board of the Architectural and Transportation Barriers Compliance. What can somebody do?
Well, for 50 years we've had the development of these laws and the Fair Housing Act and the Disability Rights Movement has passed the ADA. We're celebrating the 30 years of the ADA. So very practically, filed complaints, with the U.S. Federal Access Board, accessboard.gov, file a complaint with your city council. Let them know that there's challenges. Reach out to your Center for Independent Living. There's great centers for independent living in the whole Philadelphia area, so they can guide you to other resources and other legal supports like protection and advocacy. PNA is another resource. So there are steps you can take, but you are part of a legacy of activists that said this is not the kind of future or kind of country we want to build. We want to build a country that's more just, and you have rights. It's your right to exercise them.
I mean, it sounds like there are things to do, and hopefully you can do them. Let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Victor Pineda. He's president of World Enabled, a recognized leader in international disability rights, was appointed by President Obama to the Architectural and Transportation Barriers Compliance Board, also a lecturer at UC Berkeley. Sarah Hendren with us as well. She's an artist, design researcher, writer, professor at Olin College of Engineering, author of What Can a Body Do? How We Meet the Built World. We're talking about disability and design, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Sarah, let me go back to you. You have a chapter on Gallaudet University. This is a university features or is about deaf education, uses American Sign Language, and has created its kind of built environment to meet the needs of students and faculty. And what have they done? What does it look like?
Yeah, and actually Gallaudet and deaf education go back a long way. Actually, people don't probably know that Gallaudet, which is in Washington, D.C., was chartered by Abraham Lincoln. And so deaf education and the design around deafness has been with us for a long time. And if you go to Gallaudet now, you can see in their archives evidence of the ingenious kinds of design decisions that were made prior to the digital era. So things like a somatic doorbell, you would approach a building and pull a chain and a big stone would drop in a chamber, and that the somatic feeling of that would register among folks inside, so they would know somebody was at the door. Or, for instance, if you go now, you'll see that the light switches are outside of faculty and staff offices, so you flip those lights on up and down to announce your presence rather than knocking on the door. But just a decade or so ago, a group of students with a campus architect named Hansel Baumann, together with students and alums and faculty and staff at Gallaudet, did a kind of audit of their campus to say, what is it that deaf people in their language and also in their social ways of being know and do deeply, but is tacit, and could we make that visible in a kind of built environment with a new building? So there are a couple of new buildings on campus that proceed from what is called Deaf Space, which is a series of 100 principles about what it is that makes deafness, gives it its integrity and its vibrancy, not a kind of wish to create a condition of hearing. So, for example, there are in those new buildings, when you in a hallway, instead of coming to a hard 90-degree corner where you wouldn't hear the footsteps of somebody coming the opposite direction, there's now a curved hallway, so you've got that extended sight line. And you've got big rooms that are divided by half-height walls instead of by full walls, because you don't need a sound barrier. You need a long sight line to create, right, to be able to do that visual language at short range and medium range and long range. So when I was there, I was seeing all the ways in which deaf space is actually this kind of rejection of a curative imaginary, as Alison Kafer would say, like just a kind of an idea that there's a difference that can only be hoped for in a future where there's a cure for that, but instead to say, what if we organize around this as a variant, just a way of being in the world? So the most interesting thing, I think, is if folks are in D.C., is to go to the signing Starbucks, which is kind of an outgrowth of Gallaudet.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the signing Starbucks on 8th Street there is open to anybody. It is staffed by folks who are deaf behind the counter, and its customers are do some voicing and are hearing folks and are also deaf folks. But when I went in there as a customer and as a hearing person, I was able to immediately intuit what to do. You walk up and you write down your order on an Easy Wipe tablet, and you write your name there, and you do the automated payment in the way that you normally would, and my name came up on a monitor down the coffee bar. So no one needed to do any kind of special reorganization to make very subtle, what we'd call in my field, service design changes, so that there could be this kind of switching of the power dynamics in an ordinary world, right? You just had this very simple switch of some kind of low-tech changes, and everything changed in that interaction. And the, again, the ingenuity of it, and also the critical way of putting people with non-normative bodies and sensory organs into the public sphere in that visible way.
We're almost having a break here, but just very quickly, if you don't mind, Victor, I mean, that is putting then design at the front, not at the tail end, right? Not as a kind of add-on.
Just build it in, don't bolt it on. I think it's the core idea. And I think that design principle of nothing about us without us. Let's not build a world without really engaging the people that are going to benefit from it.
I like that, build in, not build on. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Victor Pineda. Also with us, Sarah Hendren, and we are talking about what we can learn about creating a world, designing a world, what we can learn from people with disabilities, from their own experiences, from their own ingenuity and innovations. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about what we can learn from the disability community about how to create smart cities and communities where everyone is valued, everyone can participate. And again, our guests are Victor Pineda, he's president of World Enabled, and Sarah Hendren, author of a new book, What Can a Body Do? How We Meet the Built World. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, whyy.org/Radio Times. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Victor, here's an email from Maria. She says, I never imagined I would have to view the world firsthand as a disabled or marginalized person. I don't think most of us do. But after suffering a mental breakdown and being diagnosed with severe major depressive disorder, I am now experiencing what it's like to face the stigma and snowball effects of failing to successfully navigate the world that my fully abled peers have built. Maria, first of all, thank you for sharing that with us. It's poignant and beautifully written and obviously raises a whole host of questions. And I wonder, Victor, if there's something you can say back to Maria.
Yeah, Maria, the most important part is to realize that the diversity of the human condition and, you know, having to navigate a world where you are, you know, looking at words like success or looking at words like oppression. I think that the most important thing is to know that there's a intergenerational, multiple, globally coordinated efforts to elevate the voices and experiences like you're experiencing and ensure that there are interventions and understanding and policies and investments, right? That allow us to really build a world that it does respond to that diversity of the human condition. And, you know, whether it's looking at awareness raising campaigns in your community, and whether it's empowering yourself by joining other folks and activists that are trying to elevate the rights of people that are taking seriously mental illness or mental disabilities, or even just understanding that the fundamental, you know, definition of human. If you type in human in Google, one of the definitions is just being susceptible to vulnerabilities and weaknesses. That's the part that we need to celebrate as human beings. We need to celebrate the fact that we need to ask for help occasionally. We need to be able to come together. That's, I think, something that can give us strength during difficult times.
You know, as you're talking, Victor, I have a friend, a former colleague at WHYY, Dan Gottlieb, a psychologist that our listeners know. He has quadriplegia. And what you said so much mirrored what he said about how, and being a friend and traveling with him, I got to see how he viewed the world. But he talked so much about just our human vulnerability, that we're all vulnerable, and what it is to be human. So I really appreciate you, you speaking to that. Anything you want to add to that, Sarah?
Just to underline what Victor said, I think that this, the giving and receiving of assistance, we can let it connect us to other people. And I do hope sincerely for Maria that Maria will feel not alone.
Absolutely. I'm going to make a weird leap here. Excuse me, Sarah. I'm going to go back to you. You have a whole chapter about chairs. We could do a whole hour about chairs. And we won't do justice to this chapter, but it's a fascinating look at the evolution of a chair. Most of us sit on chairs many 2 hours during the day, many, many more hours during the day that we should. Most of them, I'm sitting on a really uncomfortable bench. Most of them are really uncomfortable. And we've created this piece of furniture that really doesn't, you know, help us live our lives. Can you speak to that?
Well, it all depends on the bodies that we're in, right? So chairs can be incredibly supportive contraptions for sure. And we could talk about the whole history of the wheelchair, for example. But the chair can also be, right? And objects can be enabling and they can be disabling. And so it all depends on the body we're in. But yeah, for a lot of us, the chair is a kind of inheritance of culture and not so much designed really to maximize the ergonomic needs of our bodies. And why? Because industrial labor, if we live in post-industrial cultures, we end up doing a lot of sitting and repetitive labor. So it's not sitting in and of itself, but it's doing anything with our bodies over and over and over again, rather than the kind of range and extended forms of movement that would have been that's more natural to our bodies. So it's an invention ultimately of industry and labor that we sit in chairs all the time. And we know, because there's reams of literature that for, again, not all bodies, but for a lot of bodies, those tend to be disabling, that level of repetition. And yet it persists, right? There have been plenty of chairs redesigned over the last several decades that are kneeling chairs. And now some of us do standing desks and are taking some of that data more seriously. But boy, it is an example of the inertia of the way things are and the way things have been done, just the sheer force of that and the way that we kind of become compliant, and we tend not to feel either the agency or the permission or the, I don't know what it is, but we tend to resist that moment of saying, could this be otherwise, right? Could I rearrange and make some shifts and do something else?
I mean, could we be squatting, which I, as you're right, that's kind of where we began before chairs, right?
Well, and in lots of cultures, that squatting is a natural posture. Again, if it's mixed with other kinds of with reclining and with standing and with all of those things, and chairs can be designed to also encourage those behaviors too. And so it's not, again, any one that's better or worse than another, but this kind of trying to make our bodies into machines when they're not machines, right? Trying to make the kind of industrial labor unit of the body into a thing that only does one kind of task. That's usually pretty opposed to what our bodies are made to do. So that's a moment to say, well, again, should we adapt our bodies to the demands of the world, or can we ask the world to move its structures a little bit more toward the body? And maybe that's a design question, maybe that's a labor question, maybe that's an economic question.
Well, I have a question for you, Victor. I mean, how do you think of your wheelchair?
I mean, I used to have dreams as a child of, first I would fly out of my wheelchair, then later I would fly with my wheelchair. So that is a transformation from thinking of the wheelchair as something that was holding me back or something that was propelling me forward. So the idea that I could get in my wheelchair and literally fly around the playground, and then by extension as an adult flying around the world, is something that is very empowering. I traveled over 100,000 miles before COVID.
Wow.
In terms of giving speeches and lectures and engaging in projects, we launched an initiative called Cities for All. And I, you know, advise mayors and city officials in over 30 cities with this initiative. And that would not have been possible without me having this experience. And the wheelchair has very much been an enabling. I'm not bound or confined to the wheelchair. I'm liberated by my wheelchair.
I mean, you were literally flying in your wheelchair, right?
Yeah. there's new laws in terms of tourism. The U.S. Access Board is looking at onboard wheelchairs. New kind of developments in terms of both aviation tourism industries, which are now undergoing major rethinking during COVID. There's a lot of interventions. But I wanted to share with the audience that I, in terms of the way that we think about design and we think about cities, I think, you know, Sarah does a brilliant job in her book about really looking at the design field. I wrote a book that was published this year called Building the Inclusive City, and it's about access, justice, and the urban transformation of the city of Dubai. And looking at a lot of the work that I did as a Fulbright scholar there, to really look at a city as a complex system, looking at how international human rights norms through the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, an international treaty that I helped write and build, because it implemented was being actually put to practice in this one fantastic city. Now, the city is a complex space, but ultimately the different systems have to work together, and if they don't, people fall through the cracks. And too often those people are older people with disabilities, younger kids, where cities aren't kid-friendly cities. And so how do we take those concepts of design and universal design that were being developed for architecture and looking at universal design of an entire city?
That's
technology. Technology and smart city solutions is also one area that I think is really exciting.
Well, I'm going to look at Dubai probably with different eyes. Can I go back to you, Sarah, from the city of Dubai to a, I guess it's a home in Massachusetts where you live, where people with ALS live, and you profile a person living there who has found, you know, a great life and possibilities in this community, this very small community.
Yeah, with important things to say, just to trail on Victor's noting of smart cities, and in this case, a smart home that was built in this way prior to smart home products coming to our stores and the consumer market. That's Steve Saling, who got a diagnosis of ALS 14 years ago, and who, like anybody in his position would, was, of course, looking for medical research about treatment and cures and so on, but also, in tandem, immediately started thinking in terms of design, and his training was in landscape architecture. So he understood the power of design, and he was anticipating, it's sort of an anticipatory design practice for him to be looking ahead and thinking, I know my body will change. I know that the mobility that I have now is going to diminish over time. So how can I build a life worth living? And think about the power of that, the presumption that a life worth living can be built. And so that's what he set out to do. So he worked with software engineers and philanthropists and nursing home directors and architects to design a residence for himself and for other people with ALS and MS, all of whom use wheelchairs and all of whom use adaptive gear in that elegant way that Victor just described, to extend their bodies the way we all do, right, in different ways, extend our bodies with gear. So that the key features of the ALS, the sailing residence here in Boston, are that Steve has on his the nose bridge of his glasses a little cursor that is mounted there, and it talks to a wheelchair-mounted tablet. And with that, he can run a kind of automated house. So he can summon all the elevators, open all the doors, run the HVAC and the media and so on. And so can other people with, again, tablets that are maybe used with mouth sticks or with fingers, depending on their bodily capacity. But what Steve really created there was, you know, a kind of a life worth living, a vibrant ecosystem of care. Yes, it involves technology in it in deeply elegant ways. But the sort of resource and wisdom for all of us is to say, if and when my body changes, what will be the factors that I piece together to make a life worth living? And what indeed does make a life worth living? And he lives with help, you know, again, in the legacy of Centers for Independent Living that Victor mentioned earlier. That's the long legacy of saying help is also deeply dignified and is involved in our lives and what we ultimately want. So, and I will say there's a tension here because the smart home technologies, you know, come with a kind of compromise where we get convenience for trading our data, and we haven't worked out those kinds of ethics. Steve has a closed loop system that I think was way out in front, and it's really worth learning from.
You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We have two questions here. I'm going to put them together, and Victor, we have almost no time, but give you a chance to respond. Laurel asks, what work are you doing around city design for blind and visually impaired people? Also, an email from Joan. I have a friend who uses a walker and found the crosswalk adaptations made for the blind that have raised bumps are very scary for her because the walker becomes unstable on those. Millions of federal dollars are spent on those adaptations. Is there coordination to avoid such issues now? Can you speak to both of those questions?
Sure, yeah, very quickly. I think you could follow the work being done by the Access Board. So, yeah, at Access Board on Twitter, and then in terms of my work, at World Enabled or at Victor Pineda, you'll be able to see a lot of the work we're developing with cities. We're building a knowledge hub so that cities can share their innovations and their solutions on a public platform, get activists and city leaders and philanthropists like the Ford Foundation are really taking a look at what disability justice looks like and how to elevate those voices so that we can actually get those better designs. So we don't have enough time to go into the specific details, but join the conversation and then share your ideas and learn from each other.
And we'll try to put some information on Facebook. I know that doesn't work for everybody, but at least put some of the information out there. Victor, I mean, do you feel, Victor, that I have a sense of more optimism now an hour into our conversation, which we have to end, but I'm feeling more positive about how we can create this world for all of us.
I mean, Sarah's book and this program really highlight the need that this is the moment for us to take a major leap forward. The solutions all exist. This is not an issue of what to do. The solutions exist. We have a long history of understanding and developing inclusive design. It's important for us to be knowledgeable, informed, and then ultimately take action. Get our schools and our homes and our communities, and together, by building up that knowledge, that commitment, we can take those values and then make them build in the world, make them real in the world that we live. The hashtag I like to say is the future is accessible. That future is for each one of us to build.
Well, Victor Pineda, it's been such a pleasure. President of World Enabled, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, guys.
You're welcome. And Sarah Hendren, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure. Thanks for including me.
You're welcome. And her book is titled, What Can a Body Do? How We Meet the Built World. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, a show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.